Well, the statistics are always horrific when you hear them. For instance, that Australian police attend a call of domestic violence every 2 minutes in this country, and on average, one woman a week in Australia is killed by a current or former partner. This month is Domestic and Family Violence Prevention Month, and tonight on SBS and On Demand, journalist and author Jess Hill presents a three-part documentary series inspired by her book called See What You Made Me Do. Here's one of the stories from this powerful series.
I think technology was something that gave him a lot more power. You could easily do a Google search of me and find my Facebook page, and I'd also pop up with a couple of articles or pages relevant to my jobs. So it couldn't have taken him more than 5 minutes to get a whole bunch of intel that then allowed him to set up that dynamic where he could pretend to be very similar to me.
That's domestic violence survivor Jessica Nitschke describing her own descent into a controlling and abusive relationship. Jess Hill joins us now. Jess, welcome back to Breakfast.
G'day, Fran. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. I've only seen the first episode. It's incredibly powerful and distressing, really, and we'll talk more about Jessica's case in a moment. But your opening line says it all. There's people amongst us whose lives are not what they seem. And again, the statistics are just shocking. 3 million Australian adults and children caught up in domestic violence and affected by domestic violence. What can you tell in this documentary series that you think might help make a difference here?
Look, I think the major thing that we're getting across is just what coercive control looks and feels like. And this is a concept that's really only become known to the public in the last year or so, since Hannah Clark and her three children were killed. And the reason why it became so known is because her ex-partner, Rowan Baxter, had not used any physical violence in their relationship at all. But the coercive control in that relationship was just outrageous. And really, from everything that we know of the markers that set up a potential homicide, all of the very bright red flags were there. But because our systems don't recognise coercive control in the way that they need to, his threat was not properly picked up, even though the family knew very well just how dangerous he was. So that's what we didn't set out to make a documentary about coercive control. We started filming this before it really sort of came to the fore in the way that it has. But that's really, I think, the main takeaway from this, and the fact that the systems that we trust to protect people who are going through this too often get gamed by perpetrators and are actually facilitating the abuse.
The documentary series goes to air just, you know, within weeks of some awful, violent, horrific domestic murders, the deaths of Kelly Wilkinson, Lordy Ramadan in Queensland, baby Kobe in South Australia. Really, it gets no worse than any of these examples. Yeah. And yet in all of those, or in some of those anyway, bright red flags were there for all to see. The issue is perhaps the issue not that those who are who are part of the system to try and help protect women and children in particular aren't aware of the bright red flags, but it's just, you know, very difficult to be ever vigilant to stop the violence.
Yeah, I mean, the threat that these people are facing, and, you know, mostly women and kids, is just outrageous. The type of protection that they need is sometimes like a police car sitting outside. You know what I mean? Like, it's actually, when I hear these stories, and there's one story in that first episode where we're sitting with Deb in the safe room at the shopping center, and she's trying to plan her way out, and she's telling us how her husband has put a surveillance camera in almost every room of the house, including the children's rooms. He's like basically doesn't allow her access to money. She's got to find a moment in the day where she can be sure that he's not watching her and just make a run for it. And we know that at that moment, you know, like that's the most dangerous time to leave. And yet, like, where are the people that are going to be there with her and her kids when she runs to leave? Like, why is she being left alone to strategize something like that?
Is part of the answer to that the dimension of the problem? I mean, you talk about 3 million adults and children, and there's a stat that I learned as I was reading up for this, which is that by far and away, most cases of abuse are not even reported to police, something like 80%. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. And that's why, you know, when you hear the Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews memorably said, you know, this is Victoria's number one law and order issue, and yet we're only dealing with about, like, it's a 20% of current victims calling police. And, you know, you just think, like, imagine if everyone started calling. Like, our systems would just collapse.
Yeah, but then imagine if we needed a police car outside every moment of acute danger, as you've just described. It's impossible. So we need to go, and this is what you try and do, I think, certainly in your book. I haven't got to the rest of the series, but, you know, you do, in your book, you realise that you needed to be talking to the perpetrators. You need to understand what men were doing and how to change that. I'm imagining you go to that I know you certainly do speak to perpetrators in the series.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the really important thing, and this I made clear in the book too, is that when we're talking about men who use violence or oppression in their relationships, they're not all one and the same. You know, they don't all have the same sort of psychological needs, emotional needs. They don't have the same, they're not going to be able to be reformed in the same way. So some men may go to a 20-week behavior change program, and it may be the light bulb that goes off that sets them, you know, to changing their lives. Others, it's not even going to be a drop in the ocean. They're not even going to be able to acknowledge their violence in that time. And still another cohort, a smaller cohort, is, you know, they're going to be seriously psychologically disordered in the ways of sociopathy, psychopathy, narcissistic personality disorder. That's a small percentage, but you have to think about, what are you going to do with that extremely dangerous cohort of men who maybe are not reformable?
And what does overseas experience show us about that? If we don't have experience here, what about overseas options?
Well, overseas, so here we have, I think in Victoria, the maximum weeks for a men's behaviour change program is 20 weeks. Really overseas, we're looking at like the minimum that would see positive change, 32 weeks. Right. And in Scotland, we've got 2 years. And that's actually one-on-one counselling combined with group work. As I said, there are some people who it feels like, and it's a horrible thing to say, but it feels like the only option is to keep them off the streets in some way, or to monitor them very closely. And we show that in the series, that some of these guys are wearing GPS tracking devices themselves because they're so impulsive and so unable to be reformed that they just need to be tracked and make sure that they don't go within the vicinity of their partner or ex-partner.
Speaking of tracking devices, the first series deals with spyware. It was eye-opening for me. You show a group of former police officers who have a private security company that's used by women's refuges and others and women to try and disrupt abusive surveillance, which is high-tech, but cheap and easily available. Here's a grab of a former policeman talking about a woman who's just arrived at their company looking for help. She's on her way to a refuge.
So SafeSteps have referred her to the refuge. So before she's gone to the refuge, she's come here for us to check her car for trackers and check the phone, because he's probably tracking her, he's IT savvy.
Where might the tracker be hiding if it is being tracked?
It could be under the wheel arches, magnetically held underneath the car, in the USB port. The thing is, if there's a tracker there, we haven't got to it yet.
But that car is literally just sitting straight outside.
Sitting straight outside.
And it may actually reveal where she is.
Correct. Mm. But she's safe in here. Door's locked. We're here under cameras.
And, Jess, the point you make in those interviews is how cheap it is, how accessible it is. Is it rare? Is it not rare, this kind of surveillance by perpetrators?
No, it's extremely common. In fact, and that's why SafeSteps, which is the Family Violence Helpline in Victoria, will refer women where they can to groups like Protective Group to have their phones and their cars checked, because it's almost becoming like a matter of course. There was that group, Protective Group, they in one refuge they were working in Victoria, there were 85% of the women there were being tracked in some way, either through their phone or their car. So this is like almost... you're better off presuming that you are being tracked than thinking that you're not. That's where we're kind of at with this now.
Right. The people are quick to ask, whenever we talk about this, why don't women just leave abusive relationships? Mm. Jess, who we heard earlier, she's the start of the first episode, lays that out pretty well, I think, is that often there's not an awareness of what's going on for you until it is too late. But how do you deal with that question in the series?
Yeah, well, I think that we show, you know, that actually leaving is a heroic act for a lot of women and kids the act of leaving. It's not only the most dangerous time at that point of leaving, but what they're jumping into is entirely unknown. They're facing perhaps poverty because they don't have any access to their own finances. Maybe they've been exploited. They're facing the possibility of family court, which for some will go okay and protection will be offered. For others, they'll be facing the very real prospect of handing their kids over to a person who has been abusive and who they have just fled. I mean, basically, if we had a perfect system that said, once you leave, we will protect you, then more women would leave. But we don't. We have a very, not just imperfect system, we have a system that does not even know how it's being gamed by perpetrators and colludes with them.
Jess, it is, I think you could describe it as an epidemic, and after watching your program, there's no doubt that it is, if we didn't know that already. Importantly, just briefly, we're out of time, but this program is not just being broadcast in English, is that correct?
That's right. It's going to be, I think it's being translated into about 7 or 8 languages, which is just like so... That's the biggest thing really for me, is that this is going to reach so many different communities who really need to understand coercive control.
All right. Jess, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations. It's incredibly powerful. Thank you.
Thank you, Fran.
Journalist Jess Hill, she's presenting the series that stems from her book, See What You Made Me Do, on SBS Tonight and On Demand, a 3-part documentary series. And around it, some attendant events too, like after tonight's episode, I think there is Jess and a panel of others online to talk about it. And as she mentioned, there's other different materials being distributed along with it, and the series will be translated into several languages.